Blog Talk Radio.
Golden dreaming beauty man, is it only fantasy? Sometimes one can't help but wonder, will it ever truly be? Some people keep on saying, all is illusion and lies. Why is it so hard to believe, there are better days to see? So it seems like the world is tumbling down. It's the darkest time of night, right before dawn. Here comes the time of the dawn. Here comes the time of the dawn. Here comes the time where all the people will unite and share in a wonderful world.
Yes, blessings of here it comes. We're alive because we've been blessed to stay alive with the blessings of the Most High Creator, Eternal Creator. In Torah Chaim, instructions of life, Torah Chesed, instructions of kindness, Torah Rachamim, instructions of mercies. You're now tuned into blogtalkradio.com, and we consider ourselves humbly in our opinion. With a higher inner frequency of blogtalkradio.com, we call ourselves Soul Class. This is Soul Class 548, in search of ancient, authentic Torah. Program presentation number 130. Baruch Hashem, blessed is our Creator. Shalom, peace, and bracha, blessing upon the human family experience. With Creator's help, we're now broadcasting live on December 16, 2015. Now 9:32 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, live from Turtle Island, a.k.a. the USA, unifying souls actually. Program content will involve discussions on the following topics. The Book of Genesis, Chapter 7, verse 7, quote, "And Noah went in, and his sons with his wife, and his sons' wives with him, into the ark because of the flood waters." The Book of Proverbs, chapter 3, verse 29, "Devise no harm against your fellow when he dwells securely with you." Teachings from Rambam, Breslov / Chabad Hasidus, and reading from Rabbi Dr. Shimon David Cowan's seminal work, "The Theory and Practice of Universal Ethics, the Noahide Laws," which can be purchased by going to the following link, www.kahat.com. And when you get to kahat.com, K-A-K-E-H-O-T.com, you then type in "The Theory and Practice of Universal Ethics and Noahide Laws." Our calling number right now is 347-838-8669. Meanwhile, may the Eternal Creator bless you and protect you and your loved ones peacefully and pleasantly. Just to point out that our tags for today's program is part of our vision for our little teeny tiny input as members of the human family experience are Divine Creator, Divine Image, Torah Bible Class, Universal Redemption, and last but not least, Children of Israel, Noah praying, meditating, learning, and performing acts of kindness to eradicate hatred, jealousy, and unnecessary competition. But in order to go on with this show, we need to turn down the music. So I ask Mechila, forgiveness from blessed brother in prayer, spirit, and soul, Rabbi Isaac Baton, who happens to be right now as I'm speaking in the Holy Land, Israel, to prepare for the wedding of his wonderful daughter, Adelia, being getting married to Shaya, Yeshaya. So here we go, blessed, let's turn down the music, and on with the shoe. Sorry, Rabbi Isaac. And just to remind everyone that Rabbi Isaac is the president of Beit Mazel Shoe, which is at 1433 Kingston, President Street. 1433 President Street here in Brooklyn, New York. And every Shabbat starting at 10 a.m., President Street, I should mention, 1433 President Street is located between Kingston Avenue and Albany Avenue. And as well, that you will there, you will feast spiritually on ancient Jewish, Moroccan, Iraqi, Persian chantings on chanting out of the prayer songs according to ancient Jewish liturgy. Before we go further in the program, I just want to mention again, we do have a new sponsor for our program, a wonderful young man. His name is Robert Walker, And he has a website called Brooklyn Airs. Now, Brooklyn Airs is a company for graphic art design on T-shirts, on decals, on baseball caps, on banners. And if you can go, please, to www.brooklynairs, that's B-R-O-O-K-L-Y-N-A-I-R-E-S, that's B-R-O-O-K-L-Y-N-A-I-R-E-S.com. There you see a wide selection of things that he has designed, and you can, I'm sure you can talk with him what design you're looking for your organization, for your personal project to improve the human family experience. And please just mention my name, Don Goodman, or Don Zuccio Goodman, so he knows that I referred you to him. And then by you two partnering, you or your organization with Robert Walker, then hopefully he will be able to, according to the deal that you'll swing with him, help support our broadcasting efforts here on Blog Talk Radio. Joining me live right now in our studio, which from one perspective is quite virtual because I'm just working off my laptop. However, it's a real studio because we're broadcasting live right now into cyberspace. In this generation for each and every nation, we have Rambam student teacher, activist, and disseminator of the teachings of Rabbi Moshe Ben Maimon, Maimonides, the Rambam, the Nesher Gadol, the Great Eagle, Dennis Ryan. Good morning, sir.
Boker Tov, Don. Good morning, everybody who's listening, and I hope you're well today.
Amen. So let's get off with today's start with today's presentation, and let's just see. Yeah, we're going to be reading from a letter from 1980, and I'm sure this, for those of you who are parents and you have teenagers, this is a letter that the Rebbe wrote to someone apparently whose teenager did not want to follow doctor's orders. And I'm sure most of us have gone through the situation if our teenage children, adolescents, young adults didn't want to listen to our advice. We shouldn't be surprised when they don't want to follow the advice of a medical expert. So let's go right into the letter. And, of course, we'll be looking forward to comments and concerns by Dennis. This is to acknowledge your letter. And by the way, this is a letter written by the Rebbe in 1980. This is to acknowledge your letter of January 3rd. In accordance with your request, I will mention your son in prayer. Regarding the problem of getting your son to seek the advice of a doctor, it is quite often the case that teenagers respond less to the influence of their parents than to the influence of their friends. I believe that you will be able to find many suitable friends who will be able to speak to him and convince him to seek a doctor's advice. It would be better that your son not know that his friends were asked to convince him. I wish to add that the unwillingness to seek the advice of a doctor or to follow his instructions is quite a common occurrence, and doctors generally know how to deal with such a situation. One of the methods to overcome the reluctance, for instance, to take medication, is to prescribe a colorless and tasteless medicine that can be dissolved in milk or juice so that the young person will not suspect that he is taking the medication. Since all blessings emanate from God, it is good to remember the following matter that at times people are not paying enough attention to, that all members of the Jewish family are considered one entity and one body, and that which is beneficial to one part of his body is beneficial to the whole. Consequently, any and additional efforts in increasing matters of goodness and holiness, Torah and mitzvahs, the commandments, biblical and rabbinical, particularly on the part of the parents, broaden the channels to receive God's blessings for the entire family, and particularly to the individual who is in the most need of these blessings. Now, before I turn to Dennis, I just want to mention one thing. The Rebbe was talking to a Jewish family, and therefore he was addressing them as one entity and one body. And I hope that those who are of the nations of the world, the B'nai Noah, the children of Noah, which is basically the rest of the human family experience, aside from we Jewish people, are also part of the children of Noah experience. It's just that we've been set aside for this particular task to share these teachings and a whole host of other teachings. We want you to know, blessed souls, that if you will consider your families as one entity and one body, and that which affects one part of the body, one part of the family, affects the entirety of the personal family and, of course, the relatives as well. As well, the Rebbe had, I want to stress, the Rebbe said that one of the things that a person can do to make the situation better is, in fact, to have the parents to adhere to the teachings of God's blessings, which is the Torah with the written oral traditions. And as well, to humble themselves, the parents, to humble themselves, to go to the friends of their teenage son, who for whatever reason, as the Rebbe said, this is just a common thing. They he's turning more to the influence of his friends than his parents, which is quite expected at that teenager age life experience stage. So, Dennis, with that being said, anything you'd like to comment or bring out from what you just heard from this letter from the Rebbe?
Yes, it's an interesting subject because teenagers all over the world, Jewish, non-Jewish, are what we call in between. They're in between childhood and adulthood. They become problematic because there's a three-way pull or push. The letter mentions two of them, but there's three, and that is they have to worry about authority, whether it's their parents, their grandparents, teachers in school, or anything else. There's always authority being imposed on them. The other part is their friends are telling them this, that, and everything else. We don't know because that's a private conversation. But the other part is their mind is growing and they're questioning everything. So they have a three-way pull between authority, their friends, and themselves. So what happens here is that it leads to a little confusion. But sometimes teenagers will make a judgment without experience, and that is trying to understand the motives of themselves, their friends, and the authority. And sometimes they make the wrong choice and they reject because they don't understand. So if you don't understand, I'm not calling them ignorant, I'm just saying they don't understand. And it's very important that we try to get them to understand so that they can make a judgment for themselves, as opposed to saying, open your mouth because I'm going to show you. The real idea is to, if they have understanding and they've been brought up correctly, they will make the correct decisions. Maybe not at the moment that you introduce the motive that you're getting them to try to understand, but eventually it will sink in. So we must have patience for those teenagers who are caught in between almost everything.
Yes, yes, it can be quite painful when an adolescent falls between the safety nets, as we say, in terms of structure, which is so important. As a former certified student and eventual instructor in what is known as therapeutic crisis intervention, no matter what the behavior of the adolescent, and it really extends from little from the most beginning stages of human life until adulthood, structure is something which stabilizes the human psyche and affects human health, physical and emotional and cognitive. So it's basically about that. It is educating that person who's in that in those bridge years between pre-puberty and then going into the puberty stage and past and heading towards adulthood and what's going to be with their future, to provide them structured advice. And ultimately, it doesn't matter who gives them the advice. I mean, how good and pleasant it is when the child is adherent to everything that the parent tells them. But if, for some reason, it has to come from a peer, and the effectiveness of the delivery will be more efficient through the peer, then it's a matter of also the parents humbling themselves to this type of reality or standing within the family. With that being said, we'd like to now go on to chapter 7, verse 7. And it's a very brief verse. And also Rashi, the primary elucidator of the oral Torah tradition, does not even talk about this because it seems simple enough what's going to be explained discussed in this verse, as we'll read it right now. Noah with his sons and his wife and his sons' wives came into the ark before the waters of the flood, which already we learned last week that the water was starting to bubble up and the flood waters were on there, you know, the water was being elevated. And it was quite apparent to Noah and his family, it was time to go into the ark. Now, I just want to bring something which is not brought by Rashi, but also to give us a context, according to the oral tradition, things that all might seem common sense, still these matters are brought up for discussion in the oral Torah tradition, just to, if someone has a question, or someone is looking at these teachings very superficially, these verses, How were they provided for during that year in the ark? So So this is coming from what is known as the Zohar Chadash, which is one of the interdimensional perspectives of the Torah, from the oral Torah tradition. It says as follows: God also made a promise regarding all the food that Noah brought along for provisions. It consisted of fruit, vegetables, and grains, which would have to satisfy their needs for 12 months. And there was always a danger that much of it would rot and be spoiled. Even today, and this was in the time of the author penned this, which was in the 18th century, we see that when people are at sea for several months, their food becomes moldy, and their water can become so putrid that it is no longer drinkable. Therefore, God promised Noah that his provisions would remain fresh and usable. Now, another miracle that was brought about for the sake of Noah and his family, that the waters of the flood were boiling hot, since it had been decreed that many of the sinners should be boiled alive, meaning the people of his generation were unwilling to repent. And we talked about it last week and in previous programs, that basically there was no sense of organized civil conduct in those early human societies at the time of Noah. However, in the vicinity of the ark, the waters were cool and pleasant. And this was done in the merit of Noah, that anyone knows that when you're, you know, when you have a container and it has boiling water in it, well, of course, the sides of the container, the metal container, the plastic container, will be very hot. But if you have water, even though if you have boiling water, I should say, even if you have cool water outside of the pot, it's not going to cause any disturbance to what's inside the contents of the pot. So, as well, that one more thing before we turn to Dennis for feedback. It may be, and this, let me just see, this footnote here is from the Tractate Chagiga, which is the oral Torah tradition, the Talmudic instruction, from page 12, side A from Chagiga, with the laws of the Jewish holidays. It would be very difficult to understand the stubbornness of the people who waited until the very last minute before even attempting to repent. These people were firm in their beliefs that the world was directed by angels. They felt that they would be able to control these angels through oaths and incantations, so that the angels would not be able to do any harm with fire or water. For this alone, they deserve to be destroyed. So you might ask, we talked about, again, in previous programs, there was a lack of civility. Women were being taken from their husbands. People would go to a marketplace and there'd be a person selling his produce. And everyone would take, for instance, one grape from the collection of grapes that were being sold. And if 50 or 100 people took one grape, a sizable amount of the person's produce for sale in the market that day would be lost to stealing, even though each person would say, what does it make a difference if one grape was taken? I only took one grape. So too, that back then we have to understand, but so people were much more in tune to the obvious blessings of the Creator, yet they made the unfortunate mistake of attributing the rulership of the world to angels and not to the Almighty Creator themselves. And for this they were held accountable for, because remember, so there wasn't 7 billion people like we have today, of human beings all blessed and anointed, never to be disappointed with a divine image. There were, I don't even know what the count was, but people were more, the region where human beings live was in closer proximity to each other, and yet the general consensus was that angels were in charge of how the world was conducted on the physical level, so therefore we can ask them to intervene or try to manipulate them, because they did have great and scientific and what you would, I guess you would call Kabbalistic of knowledge of how to work with them, but that wasn't the Creator's intent, that people should become magicians and warlocks and all sorts of chicanery, which would, instead of making the world a pleasant and productive place for all members of the human family experience. Dennis?
Yes, you originally said in this segment, Don, that it's so simple, it doesn't really require an explanation, and that's why Rashi probably didn't address it.
Right.
I would like to state that it's the simple things in life that we really need the explanation for, because sometimes we tend to gloss over it or pass over it, to the point that it's so simple, it's not important. Yet, some of those very simple ideas have a lot of meaning to them. They are very deep and profound. And some people say, oh, no, that's trivia. Well, believe it or not, some of the most important things in our lives are simple, simple, simple. And we must be able to absorb it and handle it. If you can't handle the simple, why would you jump to the complicated? Because the complicated has all different sorts of impacts associated with it, while the simple is purity itself. In other words, are you good? Do you need an explanation of good, or do you know exactly what good is? It is so simple and so encompassing of so many different things.
Sure, Dennis. And with that being said, we're going from the seemingly simple, which at times does need further probing by the healthy human intellect, we're going to something which is a little bit difficult for all of us as a personal challenge with our own lives based on this verse in the book of Proverbs. And a person says that it's not a difficulty, I think they're being intellectually dishonest with themselves. And let's just read the verse and see what Rashi has to say about it and some other oral Torah commentaries on it. So chapter 3, verse 29 in the book of Proverbs reads simply as, "Devise no harm against your fellow when he dwells securely with you." Now, this is in contrast to what we learned last week or the last couple of weeks, but the idea, if you can help someone now, don't put it off tomorrow on the more socially organized level. If you are an employer, pay your employees their wages that day, although, again, we discussed we're now today in modern society that a job is a little bit more complex in terms of the payment structure, especially for a larger company. That's why people get paid every 2 weeks or every week or on a monthly basis, whatever. And as well, this whole idea of when you can do good, take the time to do it, because one day you might not be able to do it. That's basically a brief, terse synopsis of chapter 3, verse 27 in Proverbs. But today's verse, blessed souls, is that when a person gets into a situation that someone has hurt them, and it happens to be someone that they're friendly with, their neighbor, someone they might go to their local synagogue or church with, it could be a work peer, if they've been hurt by them, be very careful, blessed souls, because our tendency is to want to what? To take revenge, which is actually a biblical commandment that all people should try to avoid in taking revenge, especially when what happened to them is not something which took their life. I mean, it might have been very painful at that point. Sometimes there is some sort of financial damage, and that's something where one can go to one's spiritual counselors and, if need be, legal experts. But the Hebrew word which is used for do not devising any harm is related to the idea, the word says al tacharosh. There's a word that is similar to tacharosh, which is charish, means plowing. Rashi says, as it is customary for the plower to prepare a time for the time of sowing, so does one who devises harm prepare a place for devices in his heart, how will he get up and execute it? Meaning to go up against his neighbor, his friend, could be even a family member. And that's a very serious thing because, yes, it does hurt us when other people hurt us. But are you going to return his hurt by being just as hurtful, if not more hurtful, and just sort of like fake it and sort of live in a phony state of peace with him or her? So the question is, do we have the intestinal fortitude, blessed souls, that we are hurt by someone else, that our response would be that our initial response might be that we want to plow through the thought processes within our minds to figure out how can we respond in a way, he did that to me, well, I'll show him what happens when he does this to me. I mean, I know that this might even sound similar to, I believe it's in the New Testament, of turning the other cheek. Maybe Dennis will elaborate on that one if I'm correct in associating this type of teaching with that. It could be the source for even that teaching. But the point is, what in the Old Torah tradition, if someone does something to hurt you, that it's really upon yourself to summon up and girdle your intellectual, emotional, spiritual loins to tell them, you know, what you did was hurtful to me, and I feel hate towards the action that you did or what you spoke about me, And you should know that this matter has to be attended to, because I cannot live as the one who's been hurt by you, whoever you may be. I cannot continue to stew in thoughts where I want to devise harm against you. Now, for some people, that might seem very verbally aggressive. On the other hand, too, it's not going to solve the problem. Instead of addressing that matter with the person who hurt you, and again, who that person is and how you approach them, you have to use your wonderfully blessed human intellect infused with your divine image in order that you can come to some sort of, you too can come to some sort of rectification of the situation. It's not easy, but it's part of the living experience. And we really can't run away from this and become intellectually, spiritually, emotionally lazy, saying, he did that to me, well, I'm going to start to cook, or I'm going to start to plow devices of how to get back at them, even though outwardly it might seem that I'm totally at peace with him or her. Dennis?
Yes, all humans have a problem. And the problem is a decision to make regarding time. If you put off something, is it going to get better? Is it going to get worse? You must make that judgment while you have the time to affect the relationship, the cause, the results. If you want to clear the air on something, does it really help to wait? We humans tend to be a little lazy, and when we're lazy, we like to put things off. Well, I'll wait until a good time comes. But if you want to correct a wrong, if you want to establish relationships with other people, sometimes it doesn't really pay because it's not buying you anything if you wait. If you wait, the thing will percolate. Just like your coffee, if you drink coffee. And if you wait too long, you may miss the moment, and it may be transposed into another human instance of relationship. So we have to take action as soon as we can, but not go overboard. Because the worst thing that could happen, and all humans go through this, chastise himself by saying, I should have done something at that time. I shouldn't have let it go on too long because now I can't undo it. And it builds up in your mind as well as the other people you're affecting. So it's better to be honest and open, but you must make that decision that you let other people know you don't want to continue in this state. You want to change. You want to rectify anything you do, and you may want to introduce something new. But to sit on it and wait and see what happens is looking for future problems. We must be wary about the timing involved, what we do.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful, Dennis. I really enjoyed that commentary. And speaking to someone who was honest and open and seeking to rectify not only himself, but those who were seeking rectification, was the Rambam, Rabbi Moshe ben Maimonides, the Nesher God of the Great Eagle. What do you want to share with us today, Dennis, about this historic figure within the human family experience?
Well, today we have an interesting excerpt to read on page 454 of the online guide for the perplexed. It's called, it begins with chapter 27. And it basically encompasses some of the ideas we've already led up into the program for today, Don. So, and these are simple, straightforward ideas. So let me read here.
Fine.
The general object of the law is twofold, the well-being of the soul and the well-being of the body. The well-being of the soul is promoted by correct opinions communicated to the people according to their capacity. Some of these opinions are therefore imparted in plain form, others allegorically, because certain opinions are, in their plain form, too strong for the capacity of common people. The well-being of the body is established by a proper management of the relations in which we live one to another. This we can attain in two ways. First, by removing all violence from our midst. That is to say, that we do not do everyone as he pleases, desires, and is able to do, but every one of us does that which contributes towards the common welfare. Secondly, by teaching every one of us such good morals as must produce a good social state. Of these two objects, the one, the well-being of the body, undoubtedly first in rank. But the other, the well-being of the body, the government of the state, and the establishment of the best possible relations among men, is interior in the nature and time. The latter subject is required first. It is also treated in the law most carefully and most minutely, because the well-being of the soul can only be obtained after that of the body has been secured. For it has already been found that man has a double perfection. The first perfection is that of the body, and the second perfection is that of the soul. The first consists in the most healthy condition of his material relations, and this is only possible when man has all his wants supplied as they arise, if he has his food and other things needful for his body, example, shelter, bath, and the like. But one man alone cannot produce all this. It is impossible for a single man to obtain this comfort. It is only possible in society, since man, as is well known, is by nature social. Hi, Don.
I'm sorry, I had it on mute because I was listening to everything you were saying, Dennis. I'm sorry. As I was listening to your presentation, and thank you for sharing that piece of Rambam today from the Guide to the Perplexed.
This is the type of thinking where I draw some of these conclusions that I come out with, because to me, that's explaining the position of man to other men in human society. But at the same time, the spiritual impact here is that we were not designed to be alone. We were designed to be with other people and animals, everything that God created. But that is our purpose on life, is to exist and to create good things.
Sure. The point I want to bring up, Dennis, is that as I was listening to you, I was thinking about what we talked about before, the people in the generation of the flood of Noah, that if they only had, I mean, of course, Noah, it was divinely appointed that he should be the one to lead his generation. But if Noah had, say, had someone on the level of Rambam to have assisted him in disseminating such knowledge as he just did with us right now, and I thank you for it, I'm wondering, it might have been that a lot of the misgivings and misthoughts and improper perceptions of the people of the generation of Noah, they would have been spared a lot of suffering, and perhaps we might not have had to have the events which are described so tersely and so powerfully in the book of Genesis. So I just want to share that point. With that being said, let's move on now to Breslov and Lubavitch Chassidus. First, the teaching from Rabbi Nachman and from sharing from inspirations from a book called Erech Apayim, meaning long-standing in anger, or simply boiled down to one word, the word patience. Blessed souls, patience is a virtue which emanates from Torah teachings, both written and oral Torah traditions, as well as from all faiths and all types of philosophical outlooks. And again, we're focusing on the unfortunate, painful experience which can happen to parents, given the brief scenario will be given by Rabbi Nachman. Parents have to know that when they see that their sons and daughters of marriageable age start to conduct themselves with a certain type of arrogance towards them, meaning towards mother and father, and the parents who have struggled and toiled and sweated to bring up their lovely sons and lovely daughters, they might become astonished from where did this attitude come, and why all of a sudden the children that we have sweat and toiled over and shed a few tears of joy and the opposite of joy, why all of a sudden are they being so light-minded with our honor? not that parents should be honor-seeking, but it's just the stability of a family. I think I remember one oral Torah tradition holds that when Absalom rebelled against King David, his father, at an elderly age, the upheaval that it caused in David's life, is likened to, and the upheaval in any household where the children are rebelling openly and with an arrogance against their parents, to the type of turbulence that could be expected from the prophetically pronounced war of Gog and Magog, which again, that's a whole topic unto itself, bless his souls, because remember Rabbi Nachman, who was sharing some teaching with Rabbi Nachman, says you don't have to shoot a gun to bring Mashiach. It's just that if the human family experience doesn't get involved, all of us, and I speak of myself but anyone else, in the continual act of returning to the Creator, tshuva, repentance, then that outcome can come out. But on the interpersonal, microcosmic level of a family setup, that what's going on here, that the children are actually, in their arrogance or anger towards their parents, are actually embarrassed to ask from their parents, please, mother and father, help me get married. And what happens is their blood starts to boil, and they start to transgress the conduct that they were never engaged in before. And therefore, what happens is the children go out and decide, okay, our parents don't want to help us get married, we'll take our matters into our own hands. And, of course, you know, I just want to mention very carefully, but so this applies to Torah law, we don't force any women to get married. A woman can only be married according to her opinion that this will be her suitable mate. But I'm talking about the type of endeavor that certain children have, that once they find who seems to be a suitable life mate, they're not interested in what their parents think about the mate, because maybe they're afraid the parents will see something which might seem not favorable towards this match. And sometimes the parents will be correct in their assumptions, their perceptions. Sometimes they won't. But the fact that the children have now come to the point where they're going to preclude or exclude their parents from them helping them make one of the most important decisions of their life, bonding with a member of a man with a woman, a woman a man, and they don't want their parents involved because they have an inner, deeper, subconscious disappointment that their mother and father were not involved initially in them trying to help them get married. So, and Rabbi Nachman says not only that if the children see that the parents are not going to try to help them get married, they have their own responsibility within the context of our oral Torah tradition, that if the father, primarily with the mother, of course, do not get involved in marrying off their children, the children must, according to the oral Torah tradition, seek to get married. I mean, if the parents aren't going to help, that's not a reason for justifying them staying single or bachelors or bachelorettes for the rest of their lives. And even if the parents, because they didn't want to help the child get married, then give rebuke towards the child for wanting to get married. If the child wants to get married and feel that their age and they feel they can economically do it and they're emotionally prepared and intellectually aware of what the responsibilities will be to the greatest extent they can. Because the truth is, blessed souls, before a person gets married, they have their perceptions. They might read how to get married books, might talk to married friends. But there's a certain area of unknown that you cannot know what's behind that closed door in terms of your future destiny when marrying a certain person. So, you know, the child will feel that they have their obligation, which is rightfully so. But what I was talking about before is when they go in that process and all of a sudden the parents want to get involved, they reject their help because they feel hurt, them not initially trying to help them with this matter. And how much more so, the Rabbi Nachman concludes that when a child sees that the parents are not interested or talking to them about getting married, they might, I mean, God forbid, get involved in unsavory behavior, which will be not only an embarrassment to themselves, but it could also prove to be an embarrassment, a source of great pain to the child. So they're rather, the Rabbi Nachman saying, parents beware. If you understand your children at the age of getting married and they evidence within their behaviors on a daily basis that they are ready to get married and you make no effort, things could backfire you, even though you put in so much effort to raise them to this point in their lives. Make your effort to, as we talked about in previous programs, talk to them about what it entails to get married, what are they looking for, what can you do to help them, and after they find their potential mate and their future bride or their future bridegroom, help them out in every step of the process as much as you can, as much as you're blessed by the Most High. Dennis?
Most people learn things in life by example. And
right.
The most immediate and the first example you see is your parents.
Right.
And you learn by example from your parents. You see the relationship between your mother and father.
Yes.
Then you have to accept whether that makes sense because you see it actually happening. And then you look at the relationship between mommy and daddy. You start to understand why two people come together, because you wouldn't be the third person if they didn't. But that's the obvious. But still in all, everything that goes on between your mother and your father represents a human marriage, a human get-together, an interpersonal relationship. And that's how you set your behavior by example. So if your parents don't realize that you are picking up everything from them, they may inadvertently not control their emotions and senses. But most parents understand that, like, oh, don't talk in front of the kids like that. Don't behave like that in front of the kids.
Right.
Because they understand that the future is in the hands of the kids, and that depends on what you set. You set the bars for them. You set the level of relationship. Even your mother and father, their grandfather, grandmother, also contributes to that too. And we know that people, even though they didn't absolutely absorb everything from their mother and father and grandfather and grandmother, still remember the words of those people. Still remember some of the warnings that were said by them. And we accepted it because there was pure motive of trying to help with that. So we may have rejected it at the time, but it stays in our mind. So a lot of us, most of us, will repeat words that we didn't like our parents to say or our grandparents. But they're in their mind, they're in our mind, and we use them daily.
True. It reminds me, Dennis, what you're saying, and I thank you for those comments. You know, there is a concern of people, certain types of people, and may none of us know of these matters, that there might be a genetic disposition in the family towards, like, say, diabetes, God forbid no one should know about this, or heart issues, or bone density issues. So it might lead a person to thinking that because that's what's in my family, I'm doomed to experience that. Now, in terms of human relationships, if, like, say, one has seen, unfortunately, a high rate of divorce in one's own personal family, or matters, I mean, I hate to say it, matters of infidelity, one shouldn't feel that one is destined to go in that same unfortunate relationship scenario. The Rebbe once said that, why are there so many things mentioned in the Torah which seems to be negative behavior, or in the stories of the Tanakh, or King David wrote about, you know, staying away from certain types of behaviors. We just learned what from King Solomon, don't plow devices of, you know, intellectually or emotionally in your mind on how to harm your neighbor if they hurt you, or your friend, or work colleague, or member of your family. We have our own particular destinies, blessed souls. Yes, we are the composite of those people who came before us, and we can learn a lot by them exemplifying their behaviors, whether good, bad, or indifferent. I wanted to share one little nugget, which I might have shared once. I mean, we've done now on our 548th show, so I don't remember everything I've said. But something which my mother mentioned to me so many years ago, may she be strong and healthy, along with my father, may be strong and healthy, that she once told me, and I don't recall if she said this before I got married, or a little in my early years of marriage, she said to me, "Your father is my best friend." And she didn't say anything more than that. And I've seen in this, I mean, thank God, Baruch Hashem, my parents now are married 56 plus years. And I really can say, when my mother said it, it's because she's living it. So blessed souls, when you see people carrying out relationships in a positive way, whether your parents, your aunts, your uncles, your grandparents, It's yes, what they'll tell you is important, but watch how they exemplify what they're talking about. As the famous saying goes, actions speak louder than words. Dennis?
Well, not only that, Don, but I've experienced my kids asking me before they got married, how can you two get along? You seem like you're opposites. You don't seem you're like together. How do you do it? And
right.
I said, the answer is in your question. You have been observing it. If you can see the differences, then you understand human relations, that we're not perfect, we will never be perfect, but that doesn't stop us in believing that we are doing good.
Right.
So the purpose of doing good overwhelms a lot of other peculiarities that humans have, or peccadilloes, if you want. The peccadilloes aren't important. It's what you're dedicated to.
Right. It's like a puzzle, Dennis. You know, you have the shape of the piece that's part of the puzzle, and basically there has to be, in the area where you have to put down that puzzle piece, it has to, so to speak, be in a position to receive that puzzle piece. If it looks any other way, then even though it doesn't assume the same exact dimension as that puzzle piece, meaning that area, I mean that the space has to fit the piece, but it's empty space. It's a place that will provide. So you might say that between the space and the piece of the puzzle going to space, they're two opposites. One seems to fill up and one is empty. But that's the point. It's one mirroring the other in order that there should be a perfect union on the relationship level between husband and wife. Yes, and Bustos, guess what? Even the best of marriages, you'll see many differences. But because the whole idea is the husband and wife should come to recognize there's something beyond their differences, which brings them together despite their differences, because the truth of the matter is, if you have a happy married couple, or the advice you want to give to your children is, despite differences that might appear on the superficial level, there are more similarities that meet the eye. Any last thing that comment on that, Dennis, before we move on?
Yeah, what happens is it's a description of practicing love. And when you love something, you don't care about the warts and all the irregularities and the bad things of that person. You don't care about the little things. Why? Because love brings you above the human peccadillo level and says, can you commit so that we both can find a little happiness in this world for a while? So we know as we get older, it's temporary. But that doesn't mean we stop because it's temporary. It's as long as we breathe and as long as we practice life, there will be love.
Beautiful. We're going to move on to a little bit of Chabad Hasidus. We overextended, but I think it's important to talk about these matters because, unfortunately, we have this high rate of divorce, not just in America, but all around the world right now, which really could be quelled and reduced if people make that proper effort towards the perception of what is a relationship before going into the relationship, as they're living in the relationship in the most existential manner, and how to deal with situations when differences occur, and even beyond the initial stages of marriage, how to deal with one's children, helping them to move on to their next stage of their life. So now in the annals of Chabad Hasidus, talking about this subject matter of Adam, of man, which means human being, man and woman, that the cause of the inclusiveness that you can find in the entity, the creative being, which is called man, is because a human being is, according to our oral Torah tradition, mirroring on the human level. Let's be very careful about this. A human being is somewhat similar in design to the creator, but not creator. What does that mean? That the essence of the light, of the energy, the source of all, which is creator, is something which is not compounded or grafted together, meaning if, since there is nothing missing within creator, there's nothing that needed to be added to creator, because creator is a source of everything, who bears everything, so too, when a person, in all the matters of his or her lives, there's a design, and in that design, there is inclusive a site of bittul, a self-nullification, a self-abnegation to their design. I was thinking before the show, this whole idea, there's a song that was sung, I think it was a hit song in the 1970s, where Steve Miller, who was a rock musician, said, "I want to fly like an eagle." Okay, you have the eagle, and you have the man who sings the song, "I want to fly." Okay. And he allegorically is talking about flying like an eagle. But even if he were to fly like an eagle can fly, it would only be like. So when we say about human being that we are created, you know, with some sort of reflection of the divine one, of the created one, that doesn't mean we're going to become the creator. But the same thing, too, within our design as human beings, being human, there is a sense, ultimately, of simplicity, of completeness, which it, you cannot put into a particularized category. And that by being, when we tap into that type of consciousness, a person can sense within themselves the ability to accept another person. Because it's through the acceptance of another person that there is a greater completeness effectuated, and this becomes the design of human being in its simplicity, ultimately regarding some reflection from the microcosmic perception ultimately to the macrocosmic exponential perception as much as we can as human beings to understand. This is the design of a human being, to actually be as the creator who can bear all and is the source of all completeness and a certain ungrafted aspect to whatever creator's existence is, because there's a level of him we really, or creator, we're not even going to say he or she, is. But when we come together to sense that we come from that design of the one who bears all and is not grafted or composed of many composites, how much that makes it easier, the process of us bonding with other human beings. I'm not saying it's easy, blessed souls, but the potentiality for unity among human beings exists because of the very nature of how we're designed. Dennis?
Well, that's a very simple idea, and that's what I like, Don, because you are your neighbor. That means any other human around is you. So who are you kidding? Who are you fooling that you are different from them? Because they were all created at a creation that was given to us by the Almighty, our Creator itself, Himself, itself, whatever. We are bonded together. We're made of the same genetic material. It's all called cells. The cells were divided. We call that life when that happens. It happens in the animal world. It happens in the biological world. It happens in the human world. Cells divide. The cells that are in everybody are common to everybody. So there is an association that results in something we may not understand, but we sense it. The feeling is there. When a person dies, we feel sad. New babies, we celebrate. You may not know the person who died. You may not know the baby who was born, but we sense it. And that is the nature of humans. We are sentient beings. Even though we don't have proof, we still feel it. And that's where our faith and belief comes into everything, that God set us up to use all the potentials that we as humans have. And if we don't use it, well, we're missing a good thing that was originally given to us. But there are people who start thinking about it and say, wait a minute, maybe there's something I missed. Well, thank heavens, because we're not perfect, and you will always miss something.
True, Dennis. We're going to move to the last section of today's program, which I think has been a very potent and vital expression of not only the Torah teachings written in our Torah traditions, what we've been discussing so far, but also how it's affected Dennis and I and Dennis, in terms of how we share our awareness, our teeny tiny microcosmic awareness with the blessings of the Most High into cyberspace. We're going to be reading a little piece from The Theory and Practice of Universal Ethics, The Noahide Laws, by Rabbi Shimon David Cohen, who in the end, we're not going to read the complete section of the last part of the introduction, but a point which will hopefully will open up the eyes and help, again, our little teeny tiny efforts to help the wellsprings of Noahide awareness, of human being awareness, come to the surface, that more and more people will talk about these matters. So it goes like this. The task of the first part of this work is to elaborate the worldview, quote-unquote, the theory of the Noahide laws in terms of which one educated in secular contemporary culture will understand. Each chapter of this part is preceded by an overview or summary. Here one can offer it for a summary of summaries. The first part traces the significance and expression of the ethical worldview of the Noahide laws to the levels or perspectives of human existence. It necessarily begins with 1, the idea of the human soul made in the image of God, in which the Noahide laws gain their foundation. That's number 1. The knowledge of the soul then proceeds down, number 2, into the realm of intellect, tutoring and forming the concept of rationality itself. Thereafter, 3, the Noahide laws are understood as giving moral content to the psychological matrix of human personality as a complex of body, mind, and soul, operating in personal and interpersonal domains as well as in the domain of human nature. From understanding the Noahide laws in terms of the matrix of individual human personality, they are then grasped, 4, as the norms of organizing society collectively in its interrelated dimensions of fundamental worldview, moral culture, and social organization. From there, the Noahide laws are grasped, 5, which will be brought out later when we merit to read from those parts of the book, in the realm of the state in terms of relationship of quote-unquote private and public morality and religion and state. This discussion is extended to the role of Noahide laws in the international community of states. Dennis, any comment on this matter?
Yes. What happens is, and this is keeping it simple again, you got the Noahide laws. You can count them on your fingers. They're not complicated. They're simple. You have the Ten Commandments that were given to Moses from the Mount. They are very simple. They are not complicated. So if you keep it as simple as you can, you probably won't go that far wrong anywhere, because you'll be keeping it close to the best. In other words, don't overextend yourself thinking that you can handle all this super complicated stuff. If you can't live and breathe the simple stuff, you're going to have a hard time with everything else. But that's life. Life is not easy. And if it's not easy, the only advice I can say is smile and say a little prayer from time to time, and you'll get by.
True. Dennis, with that being said, we're about to close out today's program. I'd like to thank you profusely for using one of your most valuable resources, your precious time here on this blessed earth. Any last matter you'd like to mention before we sign off with our segue ending music by our brother in spirit, our Jews blues artist, David Dome?
Yes, and that is, have you done a good deed lately? I'm not going to answer the question. You must answer the question, because you must ask yourself that question every day.
Okay, and hopefully we can ask our question. We can ask ourselves that question, but as Dennis suggested and advised us, in the now, which is the name of the song, we've played it before, but I'd like to play it again. It's so applicable to Dennis's last statement for today's humble presentation, humble efforts. And I just want to remind you, everyone, blessed souls, that hopefully all this will be accomplished in the way of Ahava Chad, one love, Goel Chad, one destiny, Kolano for all, B'dachin Amdachi Shalom, in a pleasant way, in a peaceful way, L'ham Shik B'Zerim Yisprek, to be continued with the blessings of the Most High. And just to remind everyone, you've got to do good. I'm answering Dennis' question around about why you've got to do good, because the Tevet Tov Lehetiv, even though you might have some agit and anxiety about doing good, because maybe you didn't do so much good yesterday, but that's okay, because the nature of the good, do good, the Creator put you in this world to do that good. And Lahamshik Bezer Hashem Yisprek, to be continued. And let's now go in the now with David Dome. Take care, everyone.
It don't matter to me where you've been, the people you knew and the places you've seen. You've been hungover and you've broken a heart. We all have our very own place to start. There ain't no one who hasn't done anything wrong. And Now's your chance to make it all turn out just right. Or will you put up a fight? I've lived on both sides of the road, one in the sun and the one in the shade. The contrast is as clear as black on white. I'm seeing better in the light. Don't cling on to all your past misdemeanors. The past is done, what matters is where you are right now. Understand me somehow. Anything wrong, and now's your chance to make it all turn out just right. Or will you put up a fight? Those mistakes were made to make a better you.